GTD is available 24 hours a day on your desktop or laptop, smartphone or radio. To access 24/7 Jazz WGTD on your computer, go to WGTD.org. On your smartphone, download the free WGTD app. In the Kenosha Racine area, 24/7 Jazz HD2 is available via HD radio. And in the Waukegan and Pleasant Prairie areas, the service is being broadcast temporarily over analog radio at 103.3 FM. For more information, call 262-564-3030.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning. I'm Dwayne Olson, your host today for Education Matters on WGTD HD, Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin, at 91.1 on your FM dial and 101.7 in Elkhorn and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. WGTD is a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. Before we begin, I want to indicate that this program was recorded earlier this week. Our program today focuses on current issues in Wisconsin public education, with particular emphasis on urban education as found in Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine. My guest today is Mr. Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. Alan retired from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel after 7 years, the last 10 of which he wrote about education. As part of his activity at the Marquette University Law School, he now writes a weekly column on education for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome again to Education Matters, Alan. It's always good to have you as a guest.
And I enjoy the conversations with you.
That's wonderful. Say, I've never asked you to talk about your work in terms of rewriting your Sunday column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tell our listeners a little bit about what topics you choose and how you do your research and that sort of thing.
Oh, man, I wish I knew the answer how I choose topics. It's a pretty strange process. And I admit sometimes it's a matter of desperation. It's Friday morning, I got to write a column, and I'm thinking, what should I write it about? I was reporter and editor at the paper for many years, and the last dozen or so, I covered education, and it kind of became my thing that I was very into the subject. I was really interested in it. I thought it was important to have good coverage of it, and I was hoping I could contribute to that in terms of public knowledge of what was going on. So I left the paper in one of the many staff reductions there, buyout, in 2009. In fact, just this week we passed the 8th anniversary of my departure. So I am officially a retiree from the paper, although I haven't stopped working at all.
There you go.
So I think I'm working harder now than when I was at the paper, but just because I've kind of two jobs, including the one at the paper. And at that point, the editor at that time said to me, well, will you keep writing? And I said, well, I like the subject, and sure. And that became this weekly column, which is kind of an odd duck, I grant. It's hard to describe. I don't intend it to be just me sounding off about what I think.
Yes.
I definitely want to have some reporting in it. And my goal is much more to give people material for them to think about what's going on.
Wonderful.
I sometimes compare myself to the color commentator in the booth on the football telecast, that I'll tell you how I think the game's being played and what the team needs to do in the second half and what's wrong with the defensive backfield. But I won't tell you whether I'm rooting for the Packers or the Bears. I try to be a commentator and not an opinionator. So pretty much every week, I come up with something. And to be honest, it's just by paying attention to what's going on. And sometimes someone will say something to me and I say, yeah, you know, that's a thought that we ought to explore. The news certainly provides some material. I expected to read a lot more writing about the state budget at this point.
Yes.
The last few months, and there's been so little action that I'm sort of sitting here waiting for them to do something. But I just try to find something. And I guess I've been writing, 50 out of 52 Sundays a year, pretty much. I am thinking of slowing that down to more like 40 or so, just for my own sanity.
There you go, because I'm sure that that really is something that you have to really think about and work hard at. And the nice thing about it is you do have contacts, you know, from your previous work with the Journal Sentinel.
Yes, true. Although, to be honest, I'm just not out there as much as I used to. I work at Marquette Law School, and I actually have duties here. And so my education column stuff is really quite part-time-ish, and I'm just not at as many events and talking to as many people. So sometimes I worry I'm losing touch. On the other hand, I do think I managed to stay in it enough to know what I'm talking about. So I try not to write anything where I don't have some good reason in my own mind that I'm confident that I know what I'm talking about.
Well, I know I certainly enjoy reading your column every Sunday, and look forward to getting at that, one of the first things I do. Well, let's move on, and let's talk about one of your columns. The June 18th, 2017 column in the Journal Sentinel was about character education, with emphasis on the activities of the South Milwaukee School District. Tell our listeners what character education is and its results as you see them, and maybe why we can consider that more.
Oh, good question. And it's one of my favorite subjects these days because I am among those, and frankly, I don't know how many people there are who really think it's an important aspect of what schools should be doing. Ideally, it's something that happens at home and in the community and in the surrounding circumstances for kids. But it's so often not. And there's more and more thought being given and research being done that suggests that the attitudes and the approaches that kids, for that matter, adults, have to what they do matters hugely. If you talk to employers about what they're looking for in new employees, they'll refer to soft skills. You know, do you show up on time? Are you a team player? Are you in it just for yourself? Do you listen well? And sometimes that even includes, are you dressed decently? Do you look like a professional? Whatever that means these days. These are actually all character ed traits. You can kind of break character ed into two categories, and I am a fan of both of them in different ways. One is these things that are not really value-oriented, but apply to how you do your work. Grit. Grit became a really big word in education in the last few years, that kids who have grit, which is a number of elements of that, determination,
stick-to-itiveness,
ability to bounce back from doing something wrong, willingness to learn from doing something wrong, a general optimism about that it's worthwhile to do what they do and that I can get ahead in life, that kids who have this sense of grit and some of these related attributes do better when everything else is equal. They don't have to be smart or whatever, but if they've got that attitude, they really will get ahead more. So that's one aspect of character ed. The other would be more your classic, shall we say, Sunday school things. Be honest, be respectful, be responsible. I'm a fan of both of them. And both of them can be integrated into a school's life in very successful ways without discombobulating the basic learning. In fact, I would say enhancing the basic learning. And without a huge amount of expenditure either. And the biggest way to do this is, in my opinion, and I think I've seen research that suggests this, is the way people treat each other in the school, starting with the adults, the way teachers talk to each other or to other staff members, the way teachers talk to kids. And then that sets a tone for the way kids talk to each other, what attitudes they bring. That you can make school a place that is both emotionally healthier than might otherwise be true and more conducive to academics by setting a tone. And then there are certain programs you can do, attribute of the month. You know, I've been to pep rallies. Everybody, let's be responsible. I'm not too big on the pep rally thing, but I am big on schools that integrate that into their lives 10 months a year of be responsible, be respectful, treat each other nicely. It's anti-bullying is certainly a part of this. So it is a big subject. South Milwaukee has made a real commitment to this whole subject and has done exactly that, integrated it into their life at all of their schools, from high school down to kindergarten, and did win national recognition this year. Now, I don't remember. I think it was one of four schools nationwide. Was it three or four that was designated as a national school of character by this nonprofit organization in Washington that promotes character ed? Character.org is their main identifier. And they deserved it because they worked hard at it, and they've worked hard over time. One of the things about character ed, whether it's at home or whether it's the institutions that kids might be in otherwise or at school, is to do it over time. Only because you have a pep rally, say, we're all going to treat each other nice, that ain't going to mean anything if it isn't something that's consistent over a real span, even years.
Well, thank you, Alan, for that, because, I've thought about citizenship education, character education, and so forth, but not in the depth that you've written about it, and that's really wonderful. One of my former UW Parkside students is an elementary principal in South Milwaukee, so I'm going to have to catch up with him and perhaps do another program or a whole program on that and how it's working there in South Milwaukee.
Well, it's neither magic nor is it dramatic. It isn't like, man, look at this program. It's the subtle stuff that's there all the time that really matters. And I bet that's what he'd tell you, so or she. That would be great, I'm sure.
Okay, let's move on. Wisconsin's education budget for the 2017-19 biennium, where does it stand at this time? And you and I were talking before we went on the air.
It stands. I think it's standing somewhere out on the Capitol Square buying chorizos for lunch or something. It's so amazing because these people are all from one party, and you kind of would think, well, they're all Republicans, or for that matter, if it was all Democrats, you say they must be able to agree on things. And they haven't. They've been in a deadlock. You could see it coming from months ago, largely over the subject of roads. But education's been caught up in that. So here we are. We're into August now, and there's no budget. It isn't even really on the table as far as scheduled meetings. The Joint Finance Committee hasn't met since something like early June, at least not on the state budget. And they're still arguing over roads, over education, over bonding, which would largely be for roads. Now you've got this whole new factor of the Foxconn package.
Exactly.
So you've got the leaders of the legislature arguing which comes first, the chicken or the egg, the Foxconn or the budget. And I don't know when we're going to have a budget. It's not a problem, you could say, because Wisconsin, unlike some states, has by law that everything just keeps going the way it was in the prior 2-year budget cycle. So nobody's not getting paid or anything. But it is a problem because people want to know what's going to happen in the next 2 years.
Exactly.
And in terms of schools, they do have there are school districts that are really waiting to hire people to make some decisions about how to organize their days, the calendar of the school year and the daily cycle, based on how much money they're going to get. And the state budget is the central document for that. So people are waiting. Like I said, not a crisis, but is it a good thing? No. And now it's beginning to look like this could be still going on come the start of the school year, which for most schools is Labor Day-ish.
Exactly, yes. I can see the predicament that school districts as well as other governmental bodies are in because of the lack of the state budget. Well, cross our fingers and wish them well.
If I can add two things about that. One is it is pretty much squared away that all schools, public, charter, conventional public, charter, the private schools that are in the state voucher program, are going to get an increase of roughly $200 per student in the school year that starts in a few weeks, and then another $200 in a year from now. which is actually pretty good money compared to what a lot of educators feared they were going to get. It's not a huge windfall, and I think it'd be wrong to look at it that way. For a lot of schools, and I suspect this is true in Kenosha and Racine, it's certainly true in Milwaukee, it means the cuts and the belt tightening will be less severe than it otherwise would be, but it doesn't mean an expansion. So it's better money than in the last three budget cycles. And it's a sign that public schools and schools in general are a little more in political favor at the moment. So that's a favorable thing from the school's standpoint. The other thing is there are still voucher issues to be resolved.
Yes.
Not so much involving, there's actually four voucher programs in Wisconsin. There's the one in Milwaukee, that isn't going to change. There's the one in Racine, that isn't going to change. Those are both pretty much squared away and what I might call mature voucher programs as far as the rules they have. They're just kind of going to continue to be what they are, I think. But you got a statewide program that's beginning to grow, and there's going to be a really interesting decision still to be made as to what's going to be the qualifying level of family income for students to get vouchers statewide, because it's different now than it is for Racine and Milwaukee, and there's a lot of pressure to raise it to the level of Racine and Milwaukee. If that happens, expansion of the statewide voucher program could become quite accelerated. And then the fourth program is special education vouchers, you know, a separate program for kids who have special education needs. And that's likely to see some forms of expansion with the rules it has also. So there's still important education issues to decide that aren't set. The $200 is seems to be pretty much squared away, but there's a lot of things that schools are waiting to hear.
Right. And I was thinking about this voucher thing, too. I read a letter to the editor, I think in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel the other day, about the voucher program started out as programs then for people with low incomes and so forth. And now then what's happening is the state has been raising the income levels for people to participate to really more middle class levels.
Among people who support voucher programs, I could name names. You could have some really heated arguments between those who think all students should get vouchers regardless of income. This is the original Milton Friedman idea going back to the 1950s. Friedman, the famous economist, the
yes.
free market guy, that all students should get vouchers and can take them to any school they want. And those such as Howard Fuller, the Milwaukee educator who's so well-known nationally, who think the voucher idea is primarily aimed at helping low-income kids. The Milwaukee program, which was, as you may recall, the first program of its kind in the nation
yes.
in 1990, started out with a pretty low bar. I always forget whether it was 175 or 185% of the federal poverty table for household income to qualify. And that's gone up, and the rules have changed. Now it's 300%.
Yes. And getting to very middle class levels then.
At 300%, especially if you have several kids and two adults in a household, because it's by the number of people in a household. So if you got 5, 7, 9 people in your household, and I know families like that, you can be making pretty good income and qualify for vouchers. Pretty good income defined as $80,000-$90,000 even if you got a big family. And there's also a sweetener if it is a family, if it's a household where there's a married couple at the head of it, you get an extra break for qualifying. So that's true for Milwaukee and Racine. For the statewide program, it has been until now 185%.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty clear it's going to go up to the Senate. Republicans have proposed 220. The Assembly Republicans have proposed 300. I don't know what's going to come out of that. And then the difference in between those two numbers is pretty big as far as family income.
Go ahead.
Who is it serving? It's becoming increasingly more of a middle-class program. That is correct.
Okay. I was just reading a book review the other day from Teachers College, Columbia University. And they were talking about how the United States is becoming more racially and ethnically diverse. And one of the comments they made about this is that there's increasing social stratification in the United States as a result. Is there increasing social stratification, do you think, as a part of voucher programs? Do you have any sense for that, or have you seen any data? I haven't.
I suspect you're referring to a book that I believe David Brooks put out from the New York Times, and there's a lot to be said for this, that opportunity to move up the ladder economically is getting weaker, and that stratification, the upper middle class and upper income people are holding on to their advantages more and more. It's a pretty persuasive argument. I mean, you just look around and see it in the Milwaukee area. You look around, the difference between the demographics of the city of Milwaukee and the demographics of the suburbs in Waukesha County or Ozaukee County, it's pretty dramatic. And that shows up in income. It shows up also, frankly, in race and background of the families as far as educational attainment of the parents and so on. The voucher program, I don't think, is changing things too much one way or the other. It is a really serious issue, and it's still a serious issue. The voucher schools tend to be racially identifiable, shall we say. Tell me a voucher school in Milwaukee, and I'll tell you what its predominant racial makeup is, with a very small number that are genuine United Nations mixed schools, you know, but a little bit of everybody. But the same is true for the public schools. Tell me a public school in Milwaukee. And I think the same is probably true in Racine and Kenosha and Madison and elsewhere. And I can tell you its predominant makeup, especially grade schools. Usually high schools are a little more mixed because they draw from a wider area. But there are very few integrated, in a broader sense of the term, K-8 schools around Milwaukee and nationwide. And there's been quite a bit of writing on a national basis that integration is actually declining as people separate out by income and such, that you know, you go back 50 years, 60 years, talking about racial integration and economic opportunity and the war on poverty and all these things, and not a lot of things haven't changed, and the racial demographics, the racial factors in education are still very strong. Are things better than they used to be at a lot of these schools? Yes. There's certainly more equity in the funding and such, but it's still a huge issue.
Okay, let's move on to an issue that I have concerns about. I was a high school social studies teacher for my public school teaching career, basically American history, and thus emphasized the importance of good citizenship to my students, voting, writing letters to the editor, supporting political candidates, participating in various ways, and that sort of thing. Today I see little emphasis on citizenship as a basis for education and more emphasis on getting a good education in order to get a good job. While getting a good job is very important, how are we going to maintain our democracy without concern for good citizenship? So what can we do in our society as a whole to emphasize good citizenship?
I laugh only because it's a really good question, and you know, you get all these conflicting pressures.
Yes.
The you go back to the No Child Left Behind federal law that was signed in 2002, passed at the end of 2001 under George W. Bush's presidency, and focusing on those issues, and testing, big increase in testing that came with that law, and accountability related to testing. So many have argued, I also know that there's some studies that say this isn't as true as people say, that social sciences, even regular sciences, got pushed aside some or stepped down because of that. You also saw, you know, gym, music, art getting less attention.
Yes.
And the emphasis on reading. I have such conflicted feelings about that because I think reading is just hugely important. And especially among low-income students to this day, reading scores are just very deeply concerning. So these kids aren't going to get ahead if they can't read. So I entirely understand the priority on reading, but it does come at a price of losing some other things. You know, there's only so much you can do in a day. So you're probably right that some of the social sciences things, including citizenship programs, U.S. government courses, world politics, those kind of things. I took courses like that in high school. Of course, that was in the 1700s, I think.
Me too.
Something like that. It was a while ago. And it's, I wish there were more of it. You got one curious thing in Wisconsin, and that is 2 years ago, stuck into the state budget, had absolutely nothing to do with state spending, was a requirement that every senior in the state, every high school graduate, pass the citizenship test.
Yes.
To take to become a United States citizen. It's 100 questions, most of them multiple choice or short answer, really short answer. It's not a difficult test if you've had a civics class or if you're paying attention. I make fun of it because two of the questions, one of them is, what's the ocean off the east coast of the United States? And one of them, what's the ocean off the west coast of the United States?
Uh-huh.
And they say, oh, man, you really ought to be able to answer those questions, even if you live in the Midwest. And then a lot of them are about, you know, what are some of your rights under the First Amendment? Name the three branches of government, things like that. The test is online. The test is easy to see. In fact, it's intended to be that way. And you have to get 60 out of 100 questions right to graduate. Excuse me. And that's true whether you're in a private school or a public school, anything. To get an officially state-recognized high school diploma, you have to pass that test. That was applied to this class this year, the class of 2017, for the first time. And now in the state budget, again, why is it in the state budget? I don't know, but it is. There was a proposal to raise the pass score to 80, and now it's the Senate Republicans proposed making it 65 instead of 60. The truth is, best as I know, no one was stopped from graduating high school this year because they couldn't pass the civics test, the citizenship test. And it's partly because it's so easy to cheat on it. And you can take it any number of times. You can take it at home. All you have to do is turn it. You know, is it a good thing that kids are asked these questions and say, gee, maybe I ought to know what the three branches of government are in the United States government? It's intended to be that way. Whether it really works, I'm pretty skeptical.
Yes, okay. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the 60% and then the pressures to raise it to 80%, but hopefully...
My fourth grade grandson could pass this test pretty easily. I'm 100% confident of that. I asked some of my grandkids these questions a number of weeks ago just for fun, and to get 60 of them right, no problem.
Well, and you mentioned it in one of your recent columns, so I did Google it and did check out some of the questions and that sort of thing. So,
do you qualify to get a high school diploma?
Well, I didn't go through the whole thing, so anyway, but here I am. Okay, let's move on to another topic. Teacher shortages in Wisconsin and across the nation have been identified as an issue in these last several years. Increasing salaries certainly seems to be one response. Maybe that could be done by increasing the length of teacher contracts to 10.5 months, so they would have time to plan for the coming year, teach summer school, attend in-service programs, workshops, that sort of thing. Another potential barrier to entering teaching is the testing that Wisconsin teachers must pass today, including the EdTPA, as well as their ongoing professional development plans, PDPs, required by DPI, not to mention the college debt incurred in securing teaching licensing. Is our society ready and willing to respond to making teaching more attractive economically or just more attractive as a profession? And how can or should this be handled?
I can sum up a really complicated answer by saying I don't know. It's a really good question whether the willpower exists to make teaching a more attractive profession. And I don't think that applies only to money. I'm in favor of teachers being paid well. I think it's a really seriously important profession, and we don't treat it like that. And a lot of the hostility and sneering at teaching dissing it as a career is both wrong and really counterproductive. It's destructive. So making teaching an attractive profession is something that needs far more attention, and Wisconsin and perhaps the nation have slipped on that score pretty seriously in the last bunch of years. It's more than money. It's just general respect, prestige, the attractiveness of the profession. Certainly, and in fact, more than salary, maybe more than salary. Most teachers, when they leave the profession, if they're asked why they're leaving, money and benefits aren't at the top of the list. Frequently, it's support by the administration or by the community, overload of work, class sizes are too big, inadequate planning time. People say, oh, teachers get summers off. I know very few teachers who don't actually work on their professional development in the summers, for one thing. But for another, I know an awful lot of teachers who are working just almost constantly when school is in. They're working in the evenings, grading papers, setting up lessons, doing collaborations with colleagues that can't be done during the day. It's a really, really draining, demanding job, especially when it's done well. And we want it done well, so we have to expect
exactly.
It to be a demanding profession. So there's lots that could be done. Enrollment in college teacher programs is down sharply in Wisconsin. Some people would connect that to the legacy of the Act 10 in 2011. I'm compressing my sentences here. The Act 10 was, of course, the bill that made teachers responsible for more of their retirement benefits and their health benefits, but also stripped teachers' unions of almost all their powers and whatever effects it had or didn't have. But that's not the only factor. In fact, it's important to note that enrollment in teacher training programs is down even more in some of the surrounding states that didn't have an Act 10. So that's an important factor. There's a rise of other programs that are leading people into careers in teaching, sometimes as a second career. And some of those are good. Some of them are probably not so good. But nonetheless, they're not in an invalid route. That said, things are getting tighter, especially in certain subjects, math, science, special ed, bilingual. This has been developing for years, going back to before Act 10, and it's getting worse, and especially in high needs areas, which mostly mean the most rural and the most urban.
Yes.
Outstate, northern Wisconsin, western Wisconsin, they're really struggling to fill some of these jobs, which is one of the reasons the State Department of Public Instruction has liberalized some of its rules for getting teacher licenses, or at least emergency teacher licenses, because they need to fill the jobs.
Okay, that really sort of irks me as a professional teacher with my that kind of a background, because I can't think of any other profession where states then broaden or reduce the certification requirements. They don't do it for barbers. They don't do it for medical doctors, and that's or at least not that you hear of.
Well, it's hard to compare teaching to other professions, I'd grant. But, yeah, the arguments on this are going entirely in two different directions, and as usual, I'm sympathetic to both.
Yes.
that you say, wait a minute, we're lowering the standards for getting people in the classroom, and on the other hand, we need to get people into the classroom. And some of these rules, the DPI folks and some other education leaders from around the state, different professional organizations and such, are saying it actually is just giving them a little more flexibility. You know, I was given an example of a really veteran teacher who's really good, but they don't have the enrollment's gone down at particularly in a small school district, and they don't have enough sections of that teacher's subject to give a full-time job. So let's give that teacher a related class. Teacher's been teaching chemistry. Let's add a physics class or biology. You say the teacher's going to do okay in that. Doesn't happen to be in their license, and we get to keep the teacher and experience good teachers. So that's something I say, hey, that sounds sensible to me. But then you also so there was some advocacy, which has not carried the day at this point, that more teachers are going to be in front of kids teaching reading who haven't passed the required test going back, I think, 4 years now that Wisconsin has, that all teachers who teach reading to elementary school students have to pass a basic course and a basic test in skills in teaching reading.
And even secondary teachers have to have a reading course or reading courses with the idea that they know more about helping their secondary students with reading issues.
I am obsessed with Milwaukee, of course. And Milwaukee, to this day, although the results from this past spring's test haven't been released yet, fewer than 20% of all students in the public schools, but also in the private schools, the voucher students in both programs, fewer than 20% of them are rated as reading at proficient levels from third grade through 10th grade. And you say, wait a minute, 80% plus of the kids in the city are not rated as proficient? Man, this is a problem. We really need to focus on reading. And we're making so little progress on that in Milwaukee.
Yes. Well, I think it's a real challenge all over.
It is all over. Some places are doing better. I just was reading some data yesterday from Madison. They just released a new state of the Madison Public School District, which has more low-income and minority kids than a lot of people might realize. There's been a change in the population of Madison in the last generation. And they've made serious progress in the last few years at quite a number of schools. I'm talking about 6 points or 8 points higher proficiency rates at various elementary schools. The superintendent there, who's a very interesting person, Jen Cheatham is her name, she was saying we really need to figure out what to do with the middle schools. And high schools remain a conundrum. And high schools remain a conundrum for everybody. But nonetheless, there are places making more progress, and we need to learn from those places. And there are individual schools in Milwaukee that are making more progress.
Wonderful. At this point, I want to remind our listeners that this is your host, Wayne Olson, and you're listening to Education Matters on WGTD HD at 91.1 on your radio dial from Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin. Today, I am visiting with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, about current developments in Wisconsin public education with emphasis on urban education. Before taking his position at Marquette, Mr. Borsuk wrote on education for the Journal Sentinel and currently writes an education column for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Now back to our program, and we're getting pretty close to the end here. Alan, I want to talk about a question that I have. In fall of 2016, Racine Unified established the new Knapp Elementary School as a community school involving not only traditional PK-5 education, but also enrichment programs for students through United Way and other organizations, as well as programs for parents in the immediate community. MPS also has 5 community schools. Might this be a more successful model for educating children in poverty than other models? What do you think about that?
Well, the concept is very sensible and attractive, and that is simply that kids, you know, schools can't do it all alone. Kids are only in school so much of the time, and teachers are asked to do everything these days, not only to teach the kids, but oftentimes worry about their hygiene and their health and whether they're dressed and where they're staying at night. You've got so many kids leading really, really difficult lives, especially in low-income communities. But sometimes these things show up in the schools in the best and richest communities, so to speak. You know, there's just a lot of tough things out there. So the notion of a community school is to build an alliance between the school and a variety of other groups, health, eye care, dental, assistance to parents more on stabilizing their lives, finding jobs, getting GEDs, and bringing in a lot of allies to the school. All of this makes perfect sense. I don't know why any school wouldn't do these things. But it is a specific movement that emphasizes this. The schools in Milwaukee that are doing it are mostly schools that have very high needs, like Our Avenue School in the heart of the north side of Milwaukee. And they put more energy into the school. I think it's perked up the morale in the school, best as I know. Has it shown much in the way of results? Not that I've seen. Nationwide, there is a community schools movement, and again, it's popular, it's appealing, it's a good idea by anybody's definition, best as I can tell. You know, everything becomes politicized, though. Generally, a concept backed by teachers' unions and public school leaders like that, because it helps helps them get allies, and it also deflects some of the interest in over-reliance on test scores and advocacy for charter schools and voucher schools. So it's largely in Milwaukee been backed by unions and union allies. And on the other hand, I could take you to some of the best of the private schools and say, this is a community school. Look at what they're doing for these kids. So it's a little bit of a undefinable concept, because so much of it is just good things schools ought to be doing. But the underlying notion that kids have needs that aren't just related to sitting in a classroom, and that dealing with those needs, you know, if a kid doesn't have the right eyeglasses and can't afford to get them, can't read the board, they're not going to do well. And they come to school hungry. This is the thing about breakfast programs. They're not going to do well. So we got to deal with these fundamental life questions for kids as part of dealing with their education. That's usually sensible to me.
And it does require added resources. That does seem reasonable. One of my concerns would be I don't want the educators to be overly involved in these things, because I think they have enough to do to concentrate on the education part of their task.
Well, yes. And on the one hand, you say, well, who's going to do it if the schools aren't? The schools are where the kids show up every day. And the families, the households, unfortunately, of so many of them are broken down. There are just so many dysfunctional homes, so many kids who are kind of raising themselves and getting themselves to school. So who's going to do it if not the school? So it's unfair, but it is the reality of it.
Yes.
You know, that's why so many schools are running clothing banks for their kids or toiletries. You say, wait a minute, what does that have to do with school, whether you got toothpaste? But it does. So yes, it's unfair. Teachers ought to be free to teach and focused on teaching, but reality is way more complicated.
Okay, it surely is. Let's quickly, we're going to close with this question about Dr. Driver, then, as the new superintendent in Milwaukee, at least as of October 1st, 2014. She certainly has impressive credentials. What do you see as her successes to date, Alan?
Well, I think the jury's still out on Dr. Driver, in that there hasn't been huge changes forward. If test scores really went up, graduation rates, that kind of thing, then you'd really say, boy, this is a really successful administration. But she does have huge assets. She's really smart. She's very personable. She's very good politically, and I mean that with a small p. She's just really good with people. She's an excellent cheerleader for the Milwaukee Public Schools, and I don't mean that as a derisive term, but just someone who's really rallying people to the schools. She's supported by almost every sector and every part of the spectrum, from unions generally, not always, to Republican leaders in the legislature generally, not always. The business community is very big on her. The philanthropic community in Milwaukee is very big on her. She's had general support from the school board.
Wonderful.
But you kind of say, where's the big victories? We need some big victories here.
And you just haven't seen those. My next question is her current challenges.
Well, the situation of kids in the city remains really, really difficult, and probably worse than it was years ago. Unemployment, family dysfunction, underemployment. It's just, crime, safety, the impact of living in difficult neighborhoods. These things aren't small issues, and how much the school can overcome that. You know, the MPS is going to almost all schools having uniforms this year and some changes like that. And you say, is that going to really change things? I hope it improves the climate in schools, but, it's tough out there.
Okay. On that note, then, to our radio audience, we say thank you for being with us today as we visited with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. Mr. Borsuk currently writes an education column for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, I wish you well in your task of helping Journal Sentinel readers understand what is happening in Wisconsin PK-12 education. Yours is a most important endeavor for our students, our citizens, and our state. Finally, tune in next Saturday at 10:30 a.m. for another edition of Education Matters. This is your host, Dwayne Olson, thanking you for being with us today.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.